Welcome to the Union Jews Podcast. The UK's only all things union show. Carefully curated for your digital downloadable listening pleasure. Hello and welcome to Union Jews, the UK's only all things union podcast. I'm Simon Snapper, and in this episode we sit down with Gawain Little, General Secretary of the General Federation of Trade Unions, which this year celebrates its 125th birthday. The Federation is possibly best known for its phenomenal education and training programme, but that's by no means the only string to its bow. Gawain takes us on his trade union journey from the days of Maggie Thatcher milk snatcher and riots in Liverpool to arriving with something of a bang at the GFTU last Easter, and his vision for the future of the organisation and the movement as a whole is pretty inspiring, I've got to tell you, pretty inspiring and certainly well worth a listen. Glasgow University's Professor of Work and Employment, Mel Sims, has a different sort of trade union education on her mind in her Thought for the Week, as she ponders the contribution effective employment law can make to democracy at work, and indeed must make, in order to mitigate the excesses of capitalism. Thought for the Week follows on from our chat with Gawain. As ever, there's a companion blog over on the makesyouthink.com website with signposting, background and links if you want to follow up anything you hear on the show. But with no further ado, here we go. Gawain Little, General Secretary of the General Federation of Trade Unions. You're very, very welcome to the Union Jews podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Simon. Really, really looking forward to our chat.
Great. Well, what's been your trade union journey, if you like? What steps, what stages have brought you to the position that you currently occupy?
So I guess if I look back at where the kind of trade union values were first formed in me, I probably have to go quite a way back. I grew up in Toxteth in Liverpool in the 1980s, in a period where under a Thatcher government, we'd seen just massive cuts right across the economy. We'd seen the destruction of that social security network, mass unemployment, and you know, Liverpool amongst other areas in the country bore the brunt of that. So I guess I grew up in a context that was reasonably politicized. I always look back, and there's a playground game we used to play that I don't think I really realized the significance of it at the time when I was in primary school. People used to draw a little stick figure on one hand and a scribble on the other hand, and they'd show the stick figure and they'd say, "Here's Maggie Thatcher, throw her up and catch her, squish, squash, squish, squash. There's Maggie Thatcher." It was just a game we used to play. And you look back now and you think, wow, it must have been quite a, you know, it was at the point she'd just stolen our milk when we were in primary school. It was that whole kind of context, I guess, instilled certain values in me. And yeah. Involvement in other things, like as a child, I went to my local Woodcraft folk group, which my children now attend Woodcraft Folk, and I'm a leader with my local group in Norwich. So it's quite a nice process. But yeah, so I think that formed a certain set of values. But then I guess it was university I was involved in. I was the first year of the introduction of tuition fees university. So I was very involved in the campaigns against tuition fees. Oxford, where I was, became a bit of a center for, we had a lot of the national marches there, student occupations, all kinds of things. So again, you know, involvement in those things. And as a student, I was part of the link to the NUS, but also to the local trades council. Yeah. So that brought me into contact with other unions. And then after university, I first became a teaching assistant and joined Unison on day one, and then did my teacher training. And when I started teaching, I took over a year three class at Christmas. Someone retired, and the person who'd retired had been the union rep. So when I took over the year three class, my first day in the job, someone said to me, "He was also the union rep. I don't suppose you fancy union rep on day one." Never looked back.
But I believe I'm right in saying that you've never had a full-time officials position.
Absolutely. So I've been a lay activist in the NEU for 20 years. much of that. The last 11 years, I've sat on the union's national executive. So it was the NUT, first of all, one of the predecessor unions. I was involved in the amalgamation of NUT and ATL to create the NEU, chaired the international committee, various other roles. But throughout all of that, I've also been a lay member and I've kept up my teaching. So all of that time I was teaching primary school. I was a primary school teacher for 20 years. I was teaching part of the week and released part of the week in order to do union activism, to support people, to build the organisation. So yeah, first full-time role.
but also the value, and I think it is a not necessarily a universally recognised value of having the sort of portfolio, if you like, of activity that you've had, is you stay grounded. You know, there's no chance of your feet leaving the ground when you are spending at least part of the week on the tools, as they say, or teaching the kids.
Absolutely. And it is interesting because I still, you know, I end up in discussing with people about things and they'll say, oh, well, you know, it's like this from now. And I'm thinking, well, actually, you know, I was on the tools as it were until Easter of this year. So it's not that far away at all. And I think it'll be really important for me, certainly going forwards. Now I am in what is a full-time role. You couldn't do this post any other way, I don't think. But that I remain grounded in that. I think as we say in a book that published earlier this year on organizing, we say the organized collectives in the workplace are the point of the union. All the rest of the apparatus, everything from, you know, your local officials through to your general secretary, all of that is it's there to support that. It's auxiliary. It's there to support workers organizing in their workplaces, in their communities, on the ground. And I want to remain rooted in that as much as I can and make sure that those are the voices I'm listening to.
Well, I think we'll come on to talk more about that, I think, when we talk about the relationship between GFTU and StrikeMap, which is extremely exciting and important, I think. But what would you say are the differences or similarities between teaching and the job you're doing now? What's kind of most surprised you since taking up your current role?
So the GFT role is a really interesting one. The Federation does a wide range of different work. We're a trade union federation. We also run an educational trust that provides trade union education, a big part of what we do. We have a training centre and hotel in the East Midlands. I've never been involved in hotel management. Thankfully, I'm still not. We have a fantastic general manager and staff team there. So don't worry, I won't be I won't be interfering with that. But the breadth of what's involved has been really, really interesting. And I guess my background in a number of different campaigns and organizations has led in interesting ways to having, you know, I've been a trustee of various charities before. I've been a company secretary. So I've had different kind of links into that. But doing those range of things together has been very interesting. But if I'm honest, one of the things that surprised me most has been what some of the continuities and similarities are. Mm-hmm. So I went into teaching as a primary school teacher because I was fascinated by the way that young children learn, but also because I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to shape the minds of the future. I think that's probably why everyone goes into teaching, but it's, you know, it's hugely motivating. And of course, trade union education is a massive part of what the GFTU does. And I just feel like there's a continuity there transferred into a different context. This is about shaping the trade union activists and leaders of the future. You know, whether that's in the education sector, whether that's in steel, whether that's in post, whether it's in, you know, right across the economy, that opportunity, I guess, to play a role in shaping the leaders and activists of the future and shaping the thinking of the trade union movement going forward. We face absolutely huge challenges. And I fundamentally believe that education, a critical education, enables those activists to think for themselves, to develop ideas around collectivity and so on. It provides a huge part of the answer to those challenges. And in some ways, that's really similar to how I thought about education when I was a primary school teacher. Yeah. Empowering children with the ability to critically think about things and start to shape their own lives. It's obviously very different working with adult trade union activists to primary school children, but I think one of the biggest surprises was the continuity. Yeah.
I just think kind of around the country, as it were, people who are listening to this at that remark about the difference or the similarities between trade union general secretaries and prime ministers are going to go, ooh, I'm not sure. Okay, so I mean, given that that is the priority area for the GFTU, and as you say, there's the GFTU and the Educational Trust, an amazing range and variety of courses delivered in every which way you can imagine. Given that that's the priority area, what does success look like? What does progress look like? What metrics would we use to know that what's being done is being done effectively?
I think the GFTU is very much part of a wider trade union environment. So the first thing I'd say about what success looks like is that I think success doesn't just look like what the GFTU does, but it looks like the contribution we make to the wider movement. And I think we've, over the past couple of years, we've seen a really, really interesting contradiction. So we've had now 18 months of the most significant strike action we've had for some time, a movement that is really reactivated, that is very much on the front foot, fighting over pay, over the cost of living, etc. And of course, that's come very suddenly. You know, in 2018, we had the second lowest number of stoppages and second lowest number of people involved in strike action ever since records began in 2018. 5 years later, we're talking about a strike wave, a genuine strike wave. So really interesting transformation there. And yet, in 2022, the AR21 figures show that the trade union movement had lost 200,000 members net, overall a loss of 200,000 members, the vast majority of those being women working in the private sector. Now, I think that's fascinating. How can you have a movement that has increased profile? If you look at public approval ratings, yeah, they're at the highest they've been since approval ratings started in 1983. You know, we're there. People are aware of us. The general public approval ratings are high. Action's taking place. And yet, that hasn't translated properly into growth. Why? I think that there's a big difference between that initial involvement in action and the deeper organizing, the staying involved in the movement, the feeling like it's your movement to shape, not just that it offers something to you or that it's a vehicle for the battle you're in at the moment, but that the movement actually is yours to shape. And that's what young activists coming into the trade union movement need to feel, that these are their unions. And I think part of making that shift from simply activity to building, growing, deepening, and changing the movement is at heart about education. So for me, if I were to look at what success looks like, it's turning that picture around. It's saying we're able to link activism. Those people who've been on their first strike, attended their first picket line, who've used Strike Map to go find a neighboring picket line and gone and supported someone else's picket, those people who've had their first engagement and activity within the union, feeling it's their movement that they want to be involved and they want to shape that. And that looks like a growing trade union movement. And I think that comes out of the kind of education that we're engaging in at GFTU, because it's taking activists on their journey into how do I engage those people? How do I relate to them? How do I bring them in? But also, how do I make them the next generation of doing this? How do we make them the activists, leaders of the future? So yeah, success looks like a growing movement built on engagement and a changing movement, a movement that reflects workers in Britain in the 21st century.
No biggie then, just a small minor detail.
If you're going to do these things, you might as well set your sights high, right? Our class faces a massive, massive challenge, both in terms of the current government we've got, but also decades, 40 years of the dominance of neoliberal ideas, not just the privatization, but the attacks on terms, conditions, the stripping out of manufacturing, a productive economy, and a trade union movement that's been on the back foot for 40 years. So if you're going to have a response to that, you've got to make it a serious one. So yeah, okay, they're big aims, but they're necessary. If we're going to win, it's what we need to do.
Yeah, but also, listeners, you should be well aware of the strength and breadth and depth of the GFTU and its affiliates and its supporters and its education program. If there's any organization that can deliver on these objectives, you know, it would be the GFTU, I would say. And with that in mind, the partnership with StrikeMap, Now, I had a chat with Rob and Henry about how they saw StrikeMap, what they wanted to do with it, how they saw the relationship with the GFTU. But from the Federation's point of view, what was the attraction? What are the hopes for that sort of relationship? Is this the first of other strategic partnerships or structural changes to increase influence and reach?
So I'll start by where we came at this from as a federation. StrikeMap is, to my mind, one of the most exciting initiatives taking place within the trade union movement. It combines that use of technology, the mapping technology that they've developed, with a workers' centre, workers' built approach to engaging people in trade union activity. The whole point is to reach out to those new activists, those potential activists, people who've maybe never been on a picket line before. It's really exciting because it's not just, and sometimes we get into this, the kind of clicktivism, the technology for technology's sake, we're going to replace organizing on the ground with an online petition. StrikeMap's almost the opposite of that. It's how can we use technology? How can we use people's use of the internet, etc.? How can we use that to make things happen in the real world? So technology that develops real world activism. So we're obviously very excited about StrikeMap. And in my previous roles in the NEU, I've been a big supporter of StrikeMap in a number of ways. The NEU certainly supported it. I'm very involved in that, so I was well aware of it. GFTU, because of the mission that I set out earlier, that bit of connecting with those new activists in the movement and bringing them to the very best of trade union education, this partnership was an obvious step. I hope that for StrikeMap, what it provides is a stable home, connecting one of the most innovative new projects in the movement with an organization founded in 1899 with a long and proud history and tradition. So it gives some stability for StrikeMap going forward and an ability to grow its operation, grow what it's doing, and to engage more workers. And for GFTU, it provides that direct link to the cutting edge of the movement. We've got new workers, new activists coming in, and we can connect them directly with courses and education. So we hope to launch some new initiatives with StrikeMap now this partnership's embedded. We're already linking people up with the education program, but we want to look at how can we direct courses that are designed specifically to meet the needs of those new, because now we've got engagement with all of those people. We can start to get an idea of, well, what will draw them in. We can start to map their learner journeys for those that engage. Where's their entry point into trade union education? Where do they go from that next? Again, we're putting in place technology and working with StrikeMap to kind of map those learner journeys and say, okay, so if this is a route that leads to people becoming engaged and more active, and we're seeing that happening and we can measure that, then we can go back and we can say, how can we actively work with that route? How can we make sure that our text messaging, push notifications, all of that advertising of courses to activists in the movement is directed towards that journey so that we take them forward, ultimately building activist journeys for people for their entry point into trade unionism. And those could go in any different direction they want to take it in, but us having a greater understanding of what builds activism and development, I think, will only help. So I'm really excited around that, but there are several new initiatives we may have in the pipeline with StrikeMap to launch over the next few months. But also, is it the beginning of possibly other initiatives? I think we're certainly open to that. GFTU, as I said, founded in 1899. Next year will be our 125th anniversary. We've got a long history and a proud tradition, but we want to build on that history whilst looking to the future. The fact is, we are a changing and growing organization, and the potential for partnership working, I think, is absolutely huge. I said it earlier, we're part of a movement. Success to me is not the GFTU on its own growing or doing new things. Success to me is what the movement as a whole does and the contribution we can make to that. That means partnerships.
Yeah, I think I agree. Are there any others that you think would also be a good fit, would also complement that kind of organizational mindset, the culture of reaching out to going where people are rather than where you want them to be, and then harnessing them on a learner journey? Even if the organization doesn't exist, have you got an idea of the sort of functionality that you would like to import into the organization in the same way that the partnership with StrikeMap does?
So I guess one area that I'm really excited about is new union organising, where we are starting to organise workers in sectors of the economy where union density is either incredibly low or completely non-existent. A number of the vast majority of GFTU affiliated unions are specialist unions that operate in a particular sector or area of the economy. So there are areas, we know sectors of the economy, some of them the very casualized sectors, some of them new sectors of the economy that are very underorganized. And I'm really keen to work with partners who are looking to develop new organizing initiatives in those areas. There's, I don't know if you've come across it, but Linked to Strike Map, there's a fantastic initiative they took forward with the Bakers Union and others called Organise Now. This matches up experienced organisers volunteering their time with people who want to organise their workplace. So you call a number and you get matched up with someone with experience. Basically, it's like a mentor to help develop your organising plans, etc., and help you to build union organisation, which might then be as part of an existing trade union that organises in the sector, a union that's coming into the sector if there is no recognition in that sector, or indeed starting a new union formation. So we're obviously keen, and the work with Strike Map will enable us to work very closely, I think, with Organise Now. But that's, I guess, one of the areas that we're very, very excited about is working in organising currently unorganised workers. Let's be honest, it's the biggest challenge for a trade union movement that has shrunk. It's about 50% of its size since the mid-1970s. It's the biggest challenge, and yet far too often, if I were being critical of us as a movement, and you know, I do mean us, if I'm being critical of us as a movement, we spend too long fighting over a small number of union members who are already organised in sectors that are already organised, and not enough time looking out to the unorganised. I really want to focus on that. But I think there are other areas too. I think there are huge bits of our past, our history and tradition, that can be drawn on in new organizing. I'm a big, big believer that when you face a new challenge and you're trying to do something unprecedented, a lot of what you need to do that are in the lessons of the past and the lessons of history. Doesn't mean we always look backwards, but if you don't understand your own history, it's really hard to then develop the strategies to go forward. It's a big part of what we do within the trade union education, is bringing history, politics, economics back into that. So we're not talking, you know, functional trade union skills. We're talking that really deep, rich history and tradition we come from. So I think we're also open to partnerships that would help us develop that and reclaim, relearn, reown our own history as a movement. And then, of course, I mentioned alongside the historical aspects, economics. I think fundamentally for workers organizing now in the movement, an understanding of economics, of political economy, is absolutely essential, and it's missing from almost every union education syllabus. We used to, looking back recently at workers' education in the 20s and 30s, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people subscribed on distance learning courses, you know, with the Central Labour Colleges, with WEA, with others, distance learning courses, learning political economy, international political economics, in order to understand the struggles they faced at work. And we seem to have lost that culture, that tradition. So we're building economics and political economy into a number of our courses. We're running specific courses on it, but we've got a rather exciting collaboration with SOAS at the University of London. We've been working with the economics department there and with Kostas Lapavitsas on developing some material drawing on some of the latest ideas in political economy that are being studied within the department there, and putting those into a form where they're useful and practical for trade unionists, trade union activists in the workplace. So watch this space. We've a few things to announce over the coming weeks and months with SOAS, which I think, again, just take us into a new space where that whole question of understanding how the economy works. At the end of the day, working people, they know they're being kicked. The cost of living crisis, you can't ignore it. What they need to know is whose foot is in the boot.
Yeah, yeah.
You need economics to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you need to work out how to grab the foot and turn over the person who's kicking you.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I think an understanding of economics and political economy has to be right at the heart of a decent trade union education, alongside the history, alongside the politics, and alongside those skills that we use every day in the workplace to organise.
It's funny, isn't it, how the necessity of doing things by distance learning and correspondence, say 100 years ago, has been almost totally reversed, in the sense that, yes, we're all used to doing things remotely now, but the channels of delivery are so more widely available and so varied. It's a question of putting the student and the channel together to find what's right for each individual, I guess.
Absolutely. And I do think delivery methods really, really matter, because those distance learning courses had a lot to say for them. But what they will have lacked was that direct in real time interaction. In the same way as there's a big move, I think, now to online asynchronous learning. So you've got preloaded videos, you watch them in your own time, you go on discussion questions, put something on a forum, and you might have a response a day later or something. There's loads of potential in that to reach workers for whom release time may be difficult, etc. But it doesn't ever, I think, make up for the powers of face-to-face and particularly residential education. So again, it's something we've been really exploring at GFTU to try and get the very best blend. So a number of our core courses now, 5-day courses, our workplace reps, stage one and stage two, our health and safety, stage one and stage two, we're actually running in a blended learning model. So we're doing 3 days of residential education. And for all of our core courses, for GFTU affiliates, the course is entirely free to send members on. So that includes not just the tutoring, but the accommodation, all of the meals, etc. as well, entirely free as part of the affiliation. So it enables them, as long as they can skill that release time, it enables people to have those 3 days of intensive residential education with the group work, with the discussions in evenings, all of those bits that go with a residential course that you just can't replicate online. But days 4 and 5 are then done as online days, spaced out by about a month in between. And the idea of that is it allows us to do something that we couldn't do in the old residential courses. You can come to day 4 and you can begin with a discussion about how did we find implementing what we learned in the first 3 days in the workplace? What were the challenges you faced? How as a group can we solve each other's challenges, break down some of the barriers to implementation, which I think it's an attempt to get the best of both worlds. You've got the quality of that intensive residential education, but the opportunity to reflect a month later that you just couldn't do on a residential basis. So we're quite excited about that. And we do run a number of online courses, bite-sized things that are easy access. But as I say, we'll never be doing away with face-to-face and residential education, because it's that meeting of minds and discussion that is so much part of the trade union pedagogy. We have a really specific approach to pedagogy within trade union education, and it is about critical thinking and democratic education, where the learner is in as much control as the teacher.
Yeah, but it's also about, some people might call it networking, but it's about the solidarity and the empowerment that comes from people talking to other people and thinking, they've got the same problems as me. They've tried this, I could try that. And it you know, the energy that is released when you create that sort of dynamism, is you could run a small city off the back of it.
Absolutely. It's right at the heart of building collective identity. It's what happens in the workplace around a good rep, around good trade union organizing. That happens. But when you bring people together on residential courses, it happens across workplaces, and you begin to build a sense not just of solidarity within your workplace, your work group, your industry, but of class solidarity, that actually we face a number of the same challenges as a class, regardless of industry, and we need to organize collectively around them. No, it's powerful.
And I can see absolutely clearly how the GFTU continues to add value and continues to add added value as well. But is there a need to be mindful of what other actors in the trade union space are doing to avoid duplication?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the breadth of what there is in the trade union movement is one of its greatest strengths. The number of different unions carrying out different work, organising in different ways. And of course, the number of organisations that support them and bring them together. We have a distinct role within that. And it's changed over the years. In 1899, we were founded by the TUC, which was looking to bring together an industrial federation. It's around the same time as the founding of the Labour Party, which was the political wing of the movement. The GFTU was to be that kind of industrial federation wing of the movement. Now, in reality, now in the 21st century, that role of a trade union centre, an industrial centre, is played by the TUC itself. And we'd be the first to say there is one trade union centre in this country. It's the TUC. And, you know, it's one of the strengths of the model that we have, unlike many European countries where there are different federations based on politics, based on religion, etc. We have a single trade union federation. That's massively important. We have a specific role to play within that, that I think complements, overlaps at points, but in a positive way with the role that the TUC plays. And it is particularly around the question of education, around the question of new organizing and in new sectors, but also the majority, vast majority of our affiliates are specialist unions. They're of all different sizes, some of them quite small. They need very specific support that maybe larger, more general unions don't need and aren't looking for. So again, we provide something in that area. And it is a whole range of support we provide in different ways through some quite practical administrative things, support in terms of financial aspects and things like, there may be whole areas of work where you don't have a dedicated staff member. For example, you won't have a large international department. And yet the GFTU can become the space through which you can still carry out that international solidarity work, still link with British-based solidarity campaigns as a smaller or industry-specific union that doesn't have that wider resource in that area. And there are a whole number of areas like that. So we do some quite specialist and specific support. But as I said earlier, education, I would say, is the big focus and the big piece. And we're always keen to talk to TUC and others about how we maximize the possibilities of that working together. It's about building the movement. That's something we have to do collectively. No individual organization could do it on its own. We need to work together.
Absolutely. Well said. We're going. I mean, thanks ever so much for a fascinating discussion. I feel thoroughly energized. I'm going to get out there and redouble my commitment. I think on the back of that, it's been great. And very best of luck to you and the GFTU going forward.
Brilliant. Thank you. And for any of your listeners that want to check out what we're doing, do have a look at our courses. They are, most of them are free for members of affiliated unions, but they're also open to non-affiliates as well. So do have a look through what we're offering and get involved, get engaged. It's a really exciting time to be building the trade union movement. And I'm massively enthused by it.
Well, my thanks to Gawain, and I really hope you enjoyed that and it gave you food for thought. What I really love about the vision that Gawain and the GFTU are turning into reality is it's the joined up nature of what they're offering. There's the right blend of how education and training is delivered for each individual learner. There's a comprehensive offer in terms of courses. Of course, things like union finances. You don't get courses on union finances anywhere else, I don't think. And being on the front foot in terms of spotting gaps and adding value, like the tie-up with StrikeMap and the work on the political economy that's being done. And above all, clarity, real clarity about the purpose of the work and what success looks like. Great stuff, really, and really exciting. And all the links and signposting is in that companion blog post, makes-u-think.com. But if there's one link to remember above all others, it is gftu.org.uk. Now, thought for the week with Glasgow University's Professor of Work and Employment, Melanie Sims. This week, Mel looks at new work on understanding the importance of effective employment law and why this area is ignored at our peril.
Over the winter break, I've been reading a brilliant book by a University of Glasgow colleague, Professor Ruth Dukes. She's one of the UK's preeminent academic labour lawyers, and she has a deep knowledge of trade unions and industrial relations, both in the UK and beyond. The book is called Democracy at Work and is co-authored by Professor Wolfgang Streich, who is a brilliant economic sociologist based in Germany. Both authors have really long experience in understanding how work and employment are regulated in many different countries. And in the book, they set out to think about what needs to be done to remedy the problems that neoliberal regimes present to workers. They outline the challenge in the opening chapter, where they ask, Are growing inequality, widespread precarity, stepped up market pressure on wages and employment conditions, intensification of work, declining social protection, and mounting tensions between work and family life inevitable? Or can they and do they need to be mitigated? Now, I know Ruth well enough to know that she passionately believes that these ills do need to be addressed, and that labour law is a key institution for providing the basis for fairer regulation that can help mitigate these social problems. In the book, she and Wolfgang make a really strong case for the importance of restating the case for industrial democracy, or what they call in more contemporary terminology, democracy at work. They argue that labour law in too many countries has too often bypassed and sometimes even rejected its role as an institution of regulation between labour and capital. And it will be no surprise to listeners of this podcast that I solidly agree with the authors that the concept of democracy at work needs renewed attention. We need arguments and, crucially, actions that can address fairness in new forms of employment, such as platform work, as well as in pretty long-standing forms of work in new industries and sectors, such as work in Amazon warehouses. And both of those are examples that they use in the book. What's particularly interesting about the book is that academic life puts a lot of obstacles in the way of this kind of cooperation between sociologists and labour lawyers. I've always loved the field of industrial relations because it takes as its focus the employment relationship and then develops contributions for many academic fields to understand what goes on at work. This book is a really good example of how strong an analysis and argument can be when they draw on across disciplines. And it leaves all of us who have an interest in improving work, with the challenge of how we use our specific expertise to make the case for stronger and more democratic regulation of work. Whether we have experience as workers, managers, trade unionists, economists, lawyers, sociologists, historians, or any other plethora of area of skills and expertise, we need to be making the case louder and stronger to strengthen democracy at work. The alternative is that we increasingly leave the regulation of work to private interests of capital. And recent decades have shown us many of the problems of that approach. Ruth and Wolfgang's book renews our hopes and confidence in restating the fundamental importance of democracy at work. And that surely is a sound and optimistic starting point for the new year.
Thanks very much indeed, Mel. That point about the importance of the contribution employment law makes to justice, I think is very, very telling. Democracy at Work, Contract Status and Post-Industrial Justice by Ruth Jukes and Wolfgang Strick is available in paperback from £15.69 from a variety of online retailers. So that's just about us for this episode. Do let us know what you thought about any of the issues we've covered. You can contact the show by email at unionjews@makesyouthink.com or Jews Union on X. We'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you think. If you could rate, like, and share the podcast, that would be truly magnificent and would really help get the word out. You can also support the show by buying us a virtual coffee at our Ko-Fi site. That's Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/unionjews. That's the address you need for that. A couple of other things to let you know about. Union Jews has a sister show, Union Days, scenes from the scrapbook of union stories. Now, Union Days was shortlisted in last year's Independent Podcast Awards, and you can find Union Days wherever you get your podcast. Last but not least, Union Jews is part of the Labour Radio Podcast Network, a portal through which you can access over 200 union-related podcasts and radio shows. There is something for all ears, and you can access the portal at Labour Radio Network, all one word and Labour spelt without the U, labourradionetwork.org. In the meantime, my thanks to Mel and my thanks to Gawain, and above all, my thanks to you for your company over the last 40 minutes or so. It's been great to have you along. I really hope you enjoyed what you heard and will join us next time. Stay safe. Be kind. Solidarity with all those fighting to defend and improve terms and conditions. And I'll see you on the next Union Jews. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the Union Jews podcast, presented by me, Simon Sapper, music by Scott Holmes, a Makes You Think production.